Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, August 2nd. Today we have a Hanaho show looking at conservation in Hawaii from Mauka to Makai. We're re-airing some of our recent interviews with organizations and people working to preserve or restore our land and waters. We look at invasive grasses, the kind that helped fuel the Maui fires last August. How did they get here? And what can we do to replace them with native species? We also tell you about a mechanic who turned a personal tragedy into a passion for restoring a valley in East Oahu. Plus, the Hawaii connection to a recent documentary, The Pope's Letter to the World about our climate crisis. And using sound to restore coral populations, we learn about a new technique that could help reverse our declining reefs. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, we're re-airing recent interviews spotlighting folks helping to preserve and protect our land and sea. It's a conservation Hanaho from Mauka to Makai. We'll start with looking at flammable invasive grasses like bufflegrass and guinea grass, two that were found to fuel the Maui wildfires. In the aftermath, many have wondered if there's anything we can do to replace these non-native grasslands with fire-tolerant native grasses and shrubs. But it's an issue that's going to be hard to uproot. This past April, the National Interagency Fire Center reported that Hawaii is above normal potential for significant wildfire this spring and summer. Stephanie Jelinek is a rangeland scientist with the U.S. Forest Service. She's conducting research into invasive grasslands in Hawaii, as well as in several western states and in South Africa. She spoke to The Conversation's Maddie Bender about a new study she led on invasive grasslands on the island of Hawaii. What could it mean for efforts to reseed landscapes with native species after a fire?
Is there a single or main historical narrative as to how all the invasive grasses got here?
You know, I've been kind of digging into the history a little bit of the introduction of non-native grasses to Hawaii. And as you may know, like, cattle were brought over as a gift to King Kamehameha in the late 1700s. And it wasn't until I think the mid-1800s that ranches started coming about because foreigners were then able to own land. So there's like a series of events that have moved towards pushing towards the agricultural perspective. And I found a technical report that was dated as 1937. And I think by that time, already 140 species of grasses they had characterized. And they had in the back of that document, like, when was it brought and for what purpose? And so some of them were purposeful. A lot of them were purposeful introductions for forage. Some of them were accidental. People used to not be so great about biosecurity. And so sometimes seed lots weren't pure, and you might get something that you didn't want in your seed that you were bringing over for forage. They came on the coats of animals. There's been pulses for sure, but I think there's also been a steady drumbeat. And then, you know, there's a few species that were brought over for horticultural reasons. The fountain grass, for example, was actually brought over to look pretty. And now it's just wreaking havoc.
So let's turn now to the study. And I was reading the paper, and I wasn't expecting the Department of Defense to come up as maybe a potential inspiration.
The Department of Defense had not too long before purchased the Keamuku Maneuver Area, which they had added on to Pohakaloa training area to increase the land on which they could train. And it had been Parker Ranch land, so it had been grazed for quite some time. And once they were on the ground, the story I heard was they noticed a lot of erosion. And so this study came about from trying to figure out which grassland ecosystems would grow back the fastest. Because when you have roots in the ground of your plants, you tend to have less erosion. So that's the very small scale view, but like moving out from there in a more like general ecology kind of question, you know, we just had questions about if we disturb these landscapes, is the next invasive species going to come in and replace what was there before? Is it going to turn back into the same thing? Like, how can we get predictive in this world in which we live, in which there is so much disturbance from lots of different angles, you know, whether it's bulldozers or tanks, I guess, or cattle or fires, you know, like, what do we expect to see on the other side of that? The site offered a place that had been long disturbed, had a lot of invasive species that we didn't feel so terrible running over with a bulldozer, I guess. But also, you know, they really kind of capture a range of invasive grasses that are problematic across the different islands. And yeah, like the Mauna fire did burn over some of our study areas, and I was able to go back as a part of a field trip with the Society for Rangeland Management. They had a meeting, the California Pacific sort of section of the society had a meeting in Waimea, and they took us on a field trip, and I was like, wow, this is my old study site. And it looked exactly the same. Like, I mean, you know, little a'ali'i and, you know, some of the other native shrubs, ilima coming back, but really in a sea of that same sort of non-native grass species.
That kind of brings me to my next question. So this question of what happens to invasive grasses when a disturbance occurs.
Right. We kind of discuss the difference between colonizers, which are species that tend to get there really fast. So maybe they just pump out a lot of seed. They tend to germinate really quick and grow really fast. But then sometimes during the course of succession, they may fade out and be replaced with with your more competitive species. And so what we found is that often we were seeing the same species show up afterwards. And sometimes it shifted a little bit, and it sort of suggested that some of these species are more on the competitive side of things and might be there in the longer term. Some of them were more on the colonizer end of things and might be there more in the short term. But overall, the species composition of a site really kind of went back to the same basic assemblage. And it was the rate of coming back that was dramatically different. So with kikuyu grass, which is rhizomatous, which means that it grows from runners, it was able to come back super quick. Like, we came back 2 months later and our plots were already 100% grass. Mm-hmm. Whereas some of those slower growing species, which tend to be slower growing because they're in those hotter, drier sites, so things like buffel grass or fountain grass, those tended to be just have a lot more bare ground through the study. And so they were just coming back slower. But again, like a similar species composition at the end.
And what are the implications there for efforts to seed regions destroyed by things like fires, other natural disasters with native seeds? I mean, these are topics that are front of mind for a lot of people right now.
To me, it says, you know, so we have those plots that were, you know, beforehand they were dominated by non-native grasses, and we saw some of those native shrubs come back, you know, the ilima, the a'ali'i, and then they just kind of blinked back out. So they were out-competed by the grass, kind of grown over, and they didn't make it through. But where we had a large seed source of those, so in plots that had started out dominated by native shrubs, they managed to hang on afterwards, right? And so what that kind of tells me is it's the number of seed. And so even if you think the seed are getting there, the degree to which we can up the ante and really shift a needle in our favor just from a basic probabilistic perspective. And I think, you know, people have been doing this for a while. And part of the issue with seeding post-fire, post-disturbance is the supply chain. You know, there isn't a lot of commercial industry that just grows out seed for restoration. I was a little bit flabbergasted after 10 years of living and working with managers in Hawaii, you know, where they handpick seed on site. So in Kauai Volcanoes National Park, for example, they kind of have built a management program expecting the next fire, I guess I would say. And so they have refrigerators that are full of seeds of different things that they think they might need into the future. So after the Keaho fire in 2018, they were ready with seeds, but most organizations don't have that because they're not commercially available. And then I get, you know, to the Great Basin in Reno, and it's like, you can just buy seeds of native plants. Like, I should have known this, but it was still very surprising to me because I had worked so long in the absence of that. And so I think folks are moving towards that direction so that they can go in and reseed large areas. There's talk of aerial reseeding, helicopter reseeding from both helicopters and airplanes. But yeah, the supply chain needs to be there. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the bottleneck at this point, I think.
Native seed banks didn't have the supply, as you were saying. And so it hasn't really been possible to reseed in Maui.
Yeah. No, I think the knowledge is there, and I think it has been for quite some time. I'm going to be frank. I love doing restoration research, and I'll do it forever, but the knowledge we need is there. We kind of know what to do. It's more creating the capacity to do those things on the ground. And so in places that are closer to sea level, you just tend to have more long-term disturbance over time. There's fewer native species around for seed to be there in the first place. So there would be no expectation that these things, you know, like these places that burn over, unfortunately, you know, my expectation is there, whatever you saw before, that's what's going to be there after. So if you want to see something different, yeah, a management strategy needs to be in place.
You could maybe also look at these results and say, oh, there are certain species that take longer to rebound, like invasive species. So maybe if what you're trying to do is a short or midterm solution and you have limited resources, thinking about like strategically where those would go.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, looking at this study, Buffelgrass grew back pretty slowly. So what that means to me is you have a larger window of time where there's open bare ground for you to figure out what is the seed we're going to buy. How do we get that on the ground? Do we have the grant money for that? So it does lend a little bit of predictability to that post-disturbance window into which restoration practitioners and land managers can work if they want to put seed down.
Is there anything else on the topic of this study or habitat restoration, reseeding with native seeds, that you want to mention that you feel like we haven't yet got into?
I mean, just that planting is also an option. There are nurseries that grow out native plants, and the cost-benefit analysis is a little bit different because plants are expensive, but they are more likely to survive than a single seed. So, you know, it's a little bit of bet hedging. If you think that you can plant out 100 plants and they make it to adulthood and create their own seed, then you've kind of worked in your favor. And, you know, there's plenty of examples. I would say more at mid and higher elevation areas where there's numerous management agencies that have been replanting native species into non-native grasslands for quite some time. And so there's a huge, you know, on-the-ground knowledge base. There's a research knowledge base that exists for people to pull from, especially in terms of planting. And so, you know, not to rule that out. I know it's expensive, but the success rate's pretty high.
That was Stephanie Jelinek from the Rocky Mountain Research Station talking to HR's Maddie Bender. Her paper was published in March in the journal Ecology and Evolution. Stay tuned. We'll continue with our Conservation Hanaho show after the break.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Aloha, I'm Anita Rao, host of Embodied, a new program on Hawaii Public Radio. Sex and relationships can be intimidating to talk about, so I am here to lead the way. Join me as we explore our brains and our bodies, a journey that touches down in taboo territory. Embodied is Sundays at 10 a.m. on HPR One.
When you become a sustaining member of HPR, you help this public radio station with reliable funding year-round. Your automatic monthly donation helps power the programs you love. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
You might think you need to be the outdoorsy type or an enlightened philanthropist to start an impactful conservation effort. But sometimes all you need to be is at the right place at the right time. We Hanaho a story we brought to you last Arbor Day about mechanic-turned-conservationist Tyrone Monterey. In 2018, he unexpectedly found himself the owner of 330 acres of preservation land on Oahu. The Conversation's Russell Subiono spent a Saturday morning with Monterey and a group of volunteers amidst the foliage in Pia Valley in East Honolulu.
Well, good morning, everyone.
That's Tyrone Monterey, greeting a group of volunteers ready to pull invasive species and plant trees. He's the founder and president of the nonprofit Protect and Preserve Hawaii. Its mission, to protect Hawaii's native ecosystem by restoring Pia Valley in East Oahu. Monterey grew up in Makakilo, above the sounds of revving engines and cheering crowds at Hawaii Raceway Park. That sparked his interest in the metal-geared and gasoline-fueled world of automotive maintenance and repair. And for most of his adult life, he worked as a mechanic, until tragedy struck.
May 1st, 2018, my mother actually passed away after battling cancer for a number of years. Still grieving about it, one day I was walking to work at my other mechanic job, and I passed by this house that said it was going to be up for auction. Through the years, I always looked up real estate, and I always dreamt of having some property or investments. So I went to that auction trying to buy a condo or some kind of piece of property. At the end of that auction, I ended up coming home with a 330-acre parcel of preservation land instead. I didn't know what to do with it. Just felt like a great opportunity to own that much land in Hawaii. So what I did was just, besides freaking out, I just started doing research and figuring out what I could do with it. If you're not familiar with the area, there's Hawaii Lower Ridge to the front of me and Kulepia Moa to the back. The next ridge over, more popular known as Kuleo'o. So the first thing, I was not into conservation. I didn't know what to do with it. In 2019, I decided to do it on my own. Since then, we started reaching out to all these organizations, and I met all these people along the way that wanted to help out. So in 2020, we started our active restoration program, as well as our volunteer program. And since then, I just added the numbers again. We're up to 4.5 acres of invasive species removal and over 8,000 native Hawaiian outplantings.
Right now, Monterey is Protect and Preserve Hawaii's sole employee. Among the educational and volunteer programs he offers are Uhau Humu Pohaku, or rock wall building, and site maintenance sessions he calls Super Chill Saturdays, which is what volunteers are doing, pulling invasive guinea grass and planting the native Ala Ala Wai Nui Wahine.
Before all this happens, I didn't know the difference from any plant, invasive versus native or ecosystems. And that's why I'm super stoked to see such a lot of the younger generation catching on at such an early time in their lives versus all these other people. I'm almost going through midlife crisis, basically, I'm trying to figure out the purpose of life, when this should actually be just a part of your lifestyle, because we're all land stewards if we're all using the land for our resources. So just planting trees is not going to work. So we have to replace all these components in the ecosystem. So today we're planting a ground cover / a shrubby vine. Ala Ala Wai Nui Wahine is actually in the mint family. So now we're going to do Oli. It's a Hawaiian chant. We're going to do Eho Mai. I'll be asking for guidance today in our kuleana, or responsibilities. E ho mai ka ike mai luna mai, o na mea huna noia o na mele. E ho mai, e ho mai.
After the chant concludes, the group hikes its way to the site chosen for maintenance. They split up into three smaller groups and set loose on the sprawling guinea grass with small sickles and pickaxes. That's when my opportunity to talk to Tyrone opens up.
What's most interesting about the story is how it's seemingly a contradiction, right? You're working with non-natural things, metal and chemical oil, oils and things like that.
Highest source of pollution in the world, right?
And now you're working in nature with natural things, trying to restore it. How does
that correlate?
Yeah.
I'm a realist too, right? So I could say do things with intent. We are going to cause some pollution, but what are you doing to counteract that? How are you giving back? Are you, being carbon neutral? Are you intent with everything you do every single day, right? Whether it's plastic use or being wasteful or buying local. So, and like, that's my whole thing too, is that like, we're not asking for you to do a complete lifestyle change, but definitely to moderate and just to have intent behind your actions, no matter what it is. And that's relevant to everybody.
I imagine as a mechanic, there's a lot of little intricate details that you have to learn that is part of your job. How much of the underlying skill set of being a mechanic, how much does that play into learning to be a conservationist?
Like for me, it was, I mean, I always fascinated on how things work, and that's kind of why I became a mechanic too. So kind of like reverse engineering things. And same goes with nature, figuring out how it is and what the impacts we're causing and then what's our best way to remedy it. And also with that is like finding ways to do things more efficient. I think me having that outside perspective and coming from like a place that is focused on more efficiency and production changed a lot of the processes that I do personally on during our conservation work versus like state government, other nonprofits. We've went from like a goal of 1,000 plants a month, I mean 1,000 plants a year, to 2,000 to 2,500 plants a year. And all of our work is coming through volunteer community engagement. So it also shows that you don't need like a huge army of like professionals doing it. And it's also like giving back to the community and letting them get more connected back to the earth too.
Every place in Hawaii has a story, right? At what point did you do some investigation into the cultural history or the lineal history of this place?
So the first thing I did was basically Google the shit out of it. You know, like, what's Pila Valley, why it's named that, where it came from. And just from, like, reaching out to, like, the nonprofits in the area, I was able to kind of, you know, get the kind of, like, the background and history of it. You know, I wanted it to be to benefit the community. So they kind of went over, like, oh, you know, well, we're lucky it went to you, but at the same time, good luck. Because one of the main reasons that this land was left for the auction was because of rockfall liability. A lot of people, even the state and like land trust, was like, oh, we can't touch that, you know. So it was like, I knew if it was gonna be done, I had to do it myself. But the lineage, like, I was able to sit down with the late Laura Thompson, which was heavily involved with conservation in this area too, as well as the Voyaging Society. She sat down, she went over the whole family tree and like how they acquired the land and all that, which also made me feel like, you know, part of the area and family, even though I didn't live here.
In Hawaii, land is such an important thing. What does land and putting work into the land mean to you?
I mean, it goes back to a relationship with Aina, right? Like, it's so important, you know, living off the land and like having all these resources and being able to give back to it. Not only that, but the cultural significance of, like, mm-hmm. having all this history and then people fighting wars and, you know, having families here beforehand, it becomes just almost like family, right? Like, you know, it's not only just giving you life, but it's all the history that goes behind it too.
When it comes to the history of Pila Valley, it's an interesting one. And if you've never heard of it, that's okay. It's located in an area most people know as New Valley.
That track down there in the 50s, they called it Niu Valley, but Niu isn't a valley, it's an ahupua.
That's Kawi Lucas. She lives in a house at the entrance to Pila Valley. She's a descendant of Alexander Adams. He was a trusted advisor to King Kamehameha I. It was the king who gifted the Niu lands to Adams in the early 1800s.
So the ahupua is Niu, and I think it's like 2,500 acres. And it includes two valleys, the valleys of Pia and Kupawa, and they are bifurcated by the Kulipiamoa Ridge that you see right here.
Many of Alexander Adams' descendants have recognizable last names like Lucas. Others you may know, Pfluger, as in the car dealerships, and Thompson, as in Nainoa Thompson. Kawi Lucas spent most of her childhood in Pia Valley. She says she remembers when the area was just a collection of small farms, and over the years, landowners haven't been particularly good stewards. That's why she was a little skeptical when she heard Tyrone bought the 300-plus acre parcel in Pia Valley. But Lucas says he's given her hope the valley can be restored.
I mean, he has done such an incredible job. I still dream every day, looking this way, that all the halicoa is gone, and the natal palm, and all the other invasives, and that they're local. And what Tyrone has proved is it can be done. And I love how he just did it. He was very, very good about developing relationships in the community here first. So he did it the right way, to his very great credit. It's a dream come true. I mean, I always wanted that to happen. And I'm so glad that somebody younger and with all the energy showed up to do that. I mean, it's remarkable.
Monterey says the ultimate goal for Pia Valley is to get more people in the community educated about the area and involved in conservation. He's also hoping to one day create an outdoor education center and build out a plant nursery on the property. Before I left, I had one last question for him.
If your mom were alive today to see you, what do you think she would say?
Oh, I think she'd be super proud. You know, I think about it too. Like, I wasn't into all this, you know, but she was actually towards the end of her life here. Like, she started doing a lot of more hikes and stuff. So it's like, I knew she would be like super stoked to be telling all her hiking buddies, like, oh, come out to my son's thing, you know. And my dad always, he's still alive. He always says stuff like, you know, we're super proud of you. So I'm stoked with that. And also, like, it was kind of like, not a sign, but it's like, I feel like it was her way of like giving me something to connect to, you know, to help with her leaving, you know, and like gave me something else to have.
That was Tyrone Monterey, the founder and president of Protect and Preserve Hawaii, and Kawi Lucas talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. Greg Asner and Robin Martin are two conservation scientists who have been working on the Big Island for more than three decades. Through a collaboration with Arizona State University and the state of Hawaii, their work uses satellite technology to map the health of reefs. Their nonprofit, Hawaii Marine Education Center, was honored with the Marine Sustainability Award at the Big Island Sustainability Conference last year. They were glad to extend their reach with their scientific work. And that reach went even further with a PBS film. The couple was selected to be the voice of science in a documentary exploring Pope Francis's message about our climate crisis. It's entitled The Letter, A Message for Our Earth. The Pope invited participants to speak on behalf of four groups, the poor, the indigenous, youth, and nature. We talked to Asner and Martin, the husband-wife scientific team, about getting approached to take part in the film by the director just before the pandemic hit.
Kind of a leap of faith to jump in on this, but he said, we're looking for representatives, someone to represent the voice of wildlife and biodiversity, which turned out to be Robin and me, someone to represent the voice of the poor, the voice of indigenous peoples, and the voice of the youth. So those are three other individuals. So it ends up being five of us in the movie. Robin and I share the role of voice of wildlife, which was great because we got to do something together.
Wow, but what an honor to be the voices in what looks like a very powerful film.
Yeah, the opportunity was something that I personally didn't want to pass up. And then when I talked to Robin, we decided as a couple it would be a great idea, both to do a project together like this and also to represent the issues that humanity is facing with respect to the environment in general, but also biodiversity. And it was great because the movie really put emphasis on Hawaii as kind of an iconic example of the challenges. And so the movie crew, the filming, they came here several times, land, air, and sea. We did a lot of filming. A lot of it didn't make it in the movie, but the experience was amazing. And then, you know, to then go to Rome and join the other voices, that was a whole nother layer of experience in the process.
So when did they first start filming here in the islands?
January 2020.
Just before COVID.
Oh, just before COVID. Okay. Okay. Well, I've talked with Greg before, you know, about the research projects that you folks are working on with the satellite mapping and our reefs. But I don't know, Robin, you want to talk about, you know, just the experience, what it was that you felt when you were invited to go to Rome and meet the Pope?
Yeah. Meeting the Pope and having read the Laudato Si, which I hadn't heard of before, but it's an incredible letter to the whole world and all of the people here and humanity in general, and a cry for help, but also hopeful. You'll notice in the movies, we don't give any answers. It's just about the world itself and what's happening here, and with hope that everybody can come together and help the earth heal itself.
The other people that were tapped to represent the voices, was this the first time that you were able to meet them in Rome?
Yeah, we hadn't met anybody prior. And as Greg said, there were multiple different stories originally, and then it settled down onto the five of us. Yeah, meeting them and hearing their experiences and stories just was a really powerful experience.
And Greg, when we last talked with you, you were doing some amazing work, you know, with the mapping to help protect our coral reefs. Where are we at in this whole process?
So my team works closely with the state of Hawaii and federal government and communities to not just understand where the reefs are doing well, where they're doing poorly, but the work that we are doing has evolved to planning and executing interventions that will improve conditions on our reefs throughout the state of Hawaii. And that has a lot to do with coral reef restoration, land-based reformation, trying to get some of the pollution under control that's coming off land. We often talk about climate change, and certainly we've seen some serious climate impacts on our reefs, but our land-based problems are actually turning out to be bigger so far than the climate-driven problems. So really working land to sea, Malcolm Mackay, and working with a range of actors. When you work land to sea, you cannot just be a marine biologist. That's pretty much on the receiving end of the problem. You got to work with land decision making. That tends to be state and county and private land owners and land holders. And so it creates a reef program that is really a collaboration. And then none of that gets done without direct engagement with communities along coastlines here. So it's a busy, busy space. We're pretty much working 7 days a week trying to make progress. And you ask me, what's the status? There are areas where our reefs are doing very well, and there are really big areas where they have continued to decline. And so the challenge is to take the places that are doing well, protect those, and learn from those areas, and then work on restoring the areas that have declined based on the knowledge that we gain from the good areas. So we see it all here in Hawaii across all eight main islands, and we're trying to use the geography of this incredible place to learn the lessons and then apply them across the entire state.
And have there been challenges with the technology?
Sure. Technology is both challenging, but we also recognize that it's not the solution. The solution really rests in using the technology to inform and to monitor progress. It's really about people. So we're focused in both worlds, but the technology has been challenging, you bet. We're just at the point now where we are routinely, and I use that word carefully, not a research challenge so much anymore, but more of a routine operation, just to understand, where are the live corals? How well are they doing? Are there more or less in this area or that area? So the technology has just made those breakthroughs, and that's why we're able to turn towards communities, turn towards the harder part of this, which is all of us working together to improve these conditions for corals and coral reefs.
And Robin, you know, the work that you folks have been doing out here for, what, 30, almost 40 years, I mean, when you come across areas where you actually see the loss of the reef as you do your work out there, I mean, you know, what's that been like?
To see the loss is pretty devastating, but to know now that there are pathways to solutions is very hopeful. And as Greg was saying, you know, technology is not going to get us there. It takes the communities and So that is also our other hat. Aside from being scientists, we have a nonprofit that is positioned precisely to be the interface between science and communities and help communications and help both sides help each other. And so that's been really rewarding.
And can you name, I guess, a few places where you've seen that happen here in Hawaii?
Most recently and extensively in the community of Mililii, they just got their community-based fisheries management area passed, and that was, now it's actually in law, and it's 18.6 miles of the coastline is now under community-based protection and management. It's the first of its kind in Hawaii of such a large extent. So it's really going to be something to watch and keep an eye on, and the process is the state believes that it is the first of many that they want to put forward. So very exciting.
Greg, anything else you want to add just about the contribution that you think you folks are making, not just to all of us here in the islands here in Hawaii, but really across the globe? I mean, after coming through this experience, you know, I mean, this film is uniting, you know, so many people.
Yeah, thanks for the question and the opportunity. You know, when we decided to do this, there are two, you know, conservation scientists entering into a group that all the members come from quite different backgrounds. However, the poor, the youth, indigenous knowledge, and then this wildlife science that we represent. And people ask us, why did you ultimately do it? And it really has to do with being comfortable enough as scientists to go beyond the question of what and how. You know, as scientists, we often say, what is wrong and how do we fix it? Or we use terms like that. This movie is about the why. Why should we care so much about this? And I don't want to give the whole movie away, but I think the movie really faces the question of why this is so important. And I think when you talk to people about the why, science then doesn't become a barrier. And these other voices are given more of an even playing field with science and sort of the facts and figures of all of this. And it helps people engage, I think, a little more from the heart and the soul and the mind. And, you know, as a scientist, people thought, I think some of my friends thought that we were taking a pretty big risk. And I think it's worth taking the risk, whether you're a scientist or not. So I think that's part of the answer. One other part of it is in Hawaii itself. I've been working in Hawaii on natural resource management, conservation science for, like you said, more than 3 decades. And this idea that the government is in one posture and the communities are in another and the science community is often in yet a third kind of posture about how and what we should do. The why has got to come first, and then that will get people to work together. And Robin mentioned our nonprofit. That's really about the why, and then we sort of inject the how and what back into it. And I think those are not all the answers, but we're experimenting on the Big Island, and we're connected across the islands all the way to Kauai. And I think that there's a brighter future if we keep going down this path of breaking these barriers, reducing these silos, and getting people to really work for one another for this future that we all know we want. We don't know how to get there yet, but we know some of it. And so it's going to take more and more and more investment by people in the communities around us to get there.
That was Greg Asner and Robin Martin, who were featured in the PBS film, The Letter, A Message for Our Earth.
When you support HPR, you support community reporting about community issues.
It's been more than 8 years since a group of families from Ha'ena Kauai established the Ha'ena community-based subsistence fishing area. The community creates rules regulating catch limits, size limits, species limits, and more.
With your support, HPR brings you voices from our island communities.
It's a tool that makes sure that we can keep on practicing and fishing the way we did, and not excluding folks, but saying like, hey, if you like come fish in this area, this is how we fish, this is how we take, this is how much we take.
It's got to be community driven, got to be from the people of the place, They know their place better than anybody.
Support local reporting on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
You've heard of organ transplants, but what might be the benefit of sound transplants? For coral reefs, their acoustic footprint, called a soundscape, is a critical indicator of their health. Here's what one degraded reef in the U.S. Virgin Islands sounds like. Not much going on there. See if you can hear the difference between that and a healthy reef. Scientists at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution recorded this reef, complete with snapping shrimp, chirping parrotfish, and whistling damselfish. By playing the healthy reef sounds to reefs that were struggling, they were able to recruit up to 7 times more coral larvae to the reefs. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Nadej Aoki, the graduate student who led the new study about this new technique.
My advisor and co-author on the paper, Aaron Mooney, has been putting down hydrophones or underwater listening devices on these reefs for years. He actually started out doing some of this soundscape work in Hawaii, in Maui. And what we've observed over that time is that healthier coral reefs tend to have very acoustically distinct signatures that differentiate from more degraded or impacted reefs. So on the healthy reefs, you have this really distinct signature of a lot of complex fish aggregations that are producing those interesting grunts and burps and gurgles that you hear on those sound files. And on impacted reefs, you have some of those same sounds, but it's much quieter and there's much less of it.
How do coral hear? I'm just picturing in my head like a little pair of ears, and I know that's not right.
Yeah, it's not. But you know what? We really don't have a very solid mechanism yet for how they hear. We know that they do. We know that they're sensitive to sound, but the physiological mechanism is still under investigation. So a coral larvae, you can kind of picture as maybe about the size of a grain of rice, you know, 1 millimeter, maybe 2 millimeters long. They're a little oval shape, and they actually have ciliated hairs on their body. So they have lots and lots of little hairs around the edge of their epidermis, and some scientists hypothesize that deflections of those hairs might be a mechanism for how they sense sound, the same way that we have hair cells in our ears that help us to hear, but we really don't know yet how corals hear, and so any idea is a good one there.
Wow, that is so interesting. It's like we don't know how, but we know that they do.
Exactly. We see the effect, but we don't know the mechanism yet.
What's going on underwater, and why are these sound cues potentially really important for settlement and aggregation, and especially the very young stages of an organism like coral?
We know that for larval animals, so if we're thinking about larval stages of invertebrates like corals, when they're born or when they're first spawned, they are these very, very small organisms that don't look at all like their adult forms. And they have this opportunity then to disperse, or they may actually exhibit a certain amount of decision making. So while as they're being carried by the current, a larvae is sensitive to different cues in its environment. It's sensitive to the chemicals around it, which may be produced by different algae on different parts of the reef. It's sensitive to the light that it's sensing, so it can kind of tell whether or not it's up near the top of the water column or whether it needs to swim down to get closer to the reef. And as we're starting to learn more about, they're also sensitive to sound. And all of these things are really important because they're giving information to the larvae about what kind of area it's in and whether that's likely to be a good area for it to settle. And obviously being kind of part of a larger reef community can be a benefit for corals. It means that they might be nearby other reproductive corals for later in their life cycle. And so some of these signals, like these sound aggregations that we hear from the fish that aggregate near coral reefs can be an indicator to the larvae of, okay, this is a good place, this is the reef, this is where I want to settle. I don't want to end up on a sand patch in the middle of nowhere where there's no other corals that I can mate with in the future. So in this study, what we demonstrated is that if you record the overall soundscape of a reef and you play all of that back in an area that is not very acoustically active, that you can it kind of artificially enrich those settlement behaviors. So when we looked basically between our sound-enriched reef and we had two control reefs that we didn't play any sound on, and on average, between the two, we saw rates of settlement that were about 1.7 times on average higher in sound enriched versus the controls. But then when we compared sort of where we saw our very highest levels of settlement, which was always on our sound enriched reef compared to our very lowest rate, we saw as much as 7 times as much the settlement. And obviously, you know, we kind of take the average as that's probably where we're most likely number that we could get consistently going forward. But it was really awesome to see that much transformation in the behavior of the larvae and over a fairly short time period. So this was after a total of 3 days of exposure. What we don't know is what exactly in that acoustic soundscape is being listened for by the corals. We don't know if they are latching on to those fish sounds and thinking, oh, there's a lot of herbivorous fish nearby. That means that they're probably keeping a good control on the algae. It means that there's some of these other biological feedbacks that will be good for me. Or we don't know if it's even just a threshold. If they, you know, there's sort of a level of high enough ambient sound means this is a good area versus not.
Yeah. And as an audio editor, I know as well as you do that when you look at an audio file, it can be very hard to tease apart what the actual, mm-hmm. what are the components of the sound? Who knows if it's a voice talking,
exactly.
if it's a clicking.
And these are such complex systems with so many different inputs, not only from the biological sources, but even the differences in how much wave action you have at one site versus another, or how many boats you have going by. All of that really can affect it. And, you know, we do see these differences between healthy and degraded reefs, but like you said, it's not an absolute binary of this is great and this is bad and this one will work and this one won't.
Could you describe the setup of the playback system you use to artificially enrich these reef environments? Because when I saw the figure in the paper, I was just blown away.
Yeah, so this is something that the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, where I work, that we really excel at, or at least the engineers there excel at. So I am not an engineer. I did not design the system, but we worked with some awesome engineers who helped us to do that. And it's really cool. So the speaker that we use is one that is commercially available. People use it to put speakers in their swimming pools, or for synchronized swimming practices. And we've connected that basically to this custom designed electronics buoy that we have floating at the surface with a solar panel on top. So it gets its power from the sun. And then inside of that electronics box, we have a microcontroller and sort of all of these components that allow us to control the timing of when we play files back, and we can play whatever we want. So, you know, we could put a Beyonce song and play it on the reef if we wanted to. Obviously, we're really trying to replicate the natural sounds to start with, but it's a very flexible and like customizable system. And we're trying to make it as cost effective as possible too, so we can make a lot of them and test this in a lot of different scenarios.
Yeah, maybe the Beyonce study will be a follow-up.
Yeah, that's what everyone asks me first of all as well. Like, could you play Mozart? Would they respond to it? That's, you know, the most, would be a pretty cool paper if that came out.
Yeah. Theoretically, it shouldn't just be restricted to this one species of coral. Like, there are other species that there's evidence to suggest they can sense these auditory cues as well.
We are optimistic that we can make this happen with other species as well. We are testing that actively. We do have plans to do some of that work in Hawaii in the future. So we want to see if this works with Pacific corals as well as Atlantic. So we are planning this summer, we have a partnership with the Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary on Maui, as well as the Division of Aquatic Resources and the Maui Ocean Center Aquarium. And so we're kind of working all together, like working with Maui Ocean Center and some of their aquarium resources and their coral collections to do some of this testing on Hawaiian corals. And so we're, yes, it is actively happening. Obviously, it hasn't happened yet, and I can't speak too much about it, but we are really excited about doing it and really excited about forming these partnerships with reef stakeholders and practitioners, you know, on the ground in different reef environments.
Are there specific characteristics of a reef that would predispose it to this method working especially well or especially poorly?
Something really important to think about when implementing this technique is it's not as easy as just going to any random reef and throwing a speaker in the water. In the first place, you have to be pretty sure that there is a available larval pool there that's present. You also have to think about if you're even able to transplant larvae there and make them settle, are they going to be able to survive long term? So is there a plan in place to continue monitoring them and continue protecting them? Is there any reason to think that the water quality or any, you know, other features of that site have become too toxic to allow a lot of reef growth? So there is a lot of thought that has to go into it. And we are starting to try to feel out what are those reefs that are going to be good targets for this and what are ones where this technique might not be as effective or helpful.
It can't happen in a vacuum, no pun intended.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I just wanted to thank you again, Nadesh, for taking the time. And I really appreciated our conversation.
Thank you for having me on to talk. I hope you can tell we're really excited about this. I'm very excited to be doing this work. And it does feel, you know, it can be hard to find any stories of optimism in coral reef ecology these days. And I definitely would not say that this is a silver bullet for the tons of problems that are facing reefs, particularly anthropogenic warming. But it is nice to feel like we've added another tool to our toolkit in restoration and protection of our reefs.
That was Nadege Aoki, a graduate student at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Her new study was published earlier this year in the journal Royal Society Open Science. That does it for today's Hana Ho. Have something to share with us? We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender, with support from Savannah Harriman Pope. Our intern is Alyssa Cicido. Our backyard theme quiz written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.